Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to talk. I wish I could be there in person at PI, but hopefully that will be for this summer. So yeah, I'll be talking about some application of what I'll mention, positivity bounds. So I'll explain what I mean by that. And it's really a way to attempt to make some contact between high energy completion of gravity, for instance, and observable within the low energy effective field theory, where we can probe nature. But before I go there, let me thank my collaborators. This wants to work. Okay, here we go. And a lot of the work I'll be presenting today is in collaboration, in particular with Summer Jetley and Lasma Alberti, who've done some of the very nice work in there. So the idea behind what I'll be talking about is trying to establish some sort of contact between ultimate high energy completion of everything, so including quantum gravity, the ultimate high energy completion, to the low energy effective field theory world that we observe and that we in the way we're able to describe nature at the energy scales that we probe today. And so ideally, we would have a unique high energy completion, so beautiful by its simplicity that we can derive everything from there. And ideally, we would like to have a unique model from which it cascades down to low energy. But of course, we know that this is not at all the situation. At the moment, there's different types of high energy completions that we can consider. And there may be other high energy completions that we haven't even come up with. And there's often a plethora of models within the low energy effective field theory that are competitors. So there's not a one-to-one correspondence. Either you start from a high energy completion and you may have a landscape of various models at low energy. Or if you take a bottom-up approach in trying to describe the world, nature as we see it, there's a lot of competitor models that seem to be consistent, some of them at low energy, and yet it's hard to distinguish which one will be ultimately coming from a consistent high energy completion. In particular, we can imagine some scenario that does occur where a model may seem completely consistent at low energy. It can be, for instance, a model of dark energy, which seems to be consistent with observations that we're having at the moment. And it may seem to be self-consistent from the point of view of stability. So from the point of view of low energy, there's no reasons to believe that this model is not a good candidate for a description of dark energy or whatever other phenomenon that you are interested in. But we know that in some cases, the models that we're considering at low energy will never be embeddable in a standard high energy completion. And the word standard is very loaded, so I'll explain what I mean by standard. And not everybody has exactly the same qualification of what they mean by standard. So I'll be very careful in letting you know what the assumptions behind standard high energy completion are. But you will see that there are diagnoses that allows you to make communication between the low energy world that we see with its high potential high energy completion, and sometimes within the framework at low energy, without making contact with high energy, it would be impossible to discriminate between various type of models. Now, in what I'm talking about, in particular, the fact that we have a landscape of various type of effective field theories at low energy, this seems very similar to what one does when we have a model coming from string theory. And from the low energy perspective, your model can either be in the landscape of string theory, or it can be the swampland. And in the past few years, there's a lot of swampland conjecture that have been postulated in trying to understand whether a model could or not be coming from a specific realization of string theory. The question people are asking themselves in conjecturing some of the swampland conjectures are quite, maybe I should say complementary, but still slightly different to the type of assumptions that we're making, that I'll be making throughout this talk. So if there was such a thing as an arrow of assumptions, of course, this is very symbolic, and I'm not entirely sure what to put the swampland conjecture there. But in terms of assumptions that I will impose on myself, in terms of what the high energy completion should be, for instance, I can be a little bit clearer in that you can be very specific. You may want to commit to a specific model of string theory, or you may be committing to having a tree-level weekly a couple realization, or you can relax some of those assumptions. You just want the UV completion to be weakly coupled and satisfy unitarity, locality, Poincaré invariance, and causality. So these are type of implementation at high energy that you may want to impose on yourself, or you can be a little bit more generic and not wanting weak coupling and just impose those type of conditions. And this is what I'll understand, this is what I'll take for granted in the qualification of a standard high energy completion. For me, a standard high energy completion is a high energy completion which will satisfy these four criteria. And definitely that of locality can very much be debated, and I'll discuss a lot of the instances on how it can be debated and what we can learn by imposing it and seeing what happens from the point of view of the low energy effective field theory, if we impose some notion of locality or not. To be precise, the level of locality that I will impose on myself is a level of locality which is satisfied in string theory. So even though you have strings being extended objects, what I mean by locality, I'll explain in a bit, is really the Foissat bound being satisfied. And we typically expect this to be satisfied in amplitudes arising from string theory. So if I'm imposing myself those type of conditions to be valid all the way up to infinitely large high energy scales, I will show how we can derive some, what I mentioned, positivity bounds applicable within the regime of validity of a low energy effective field theory. Of course, we can relax some of those assumptions. In particular, we can relax part of Poincaré invariance, and we can relax the notion of locality. But just to see where I'm starting with, this will be the level of the assumptions that I'm going to impose on myself. And then I'll run through that. And then if we see that we end up with criteria within the low energy effective field theory, which are incompatible with what nature gives us, then it allows us to re-examine some of these assumptions and wondering whether nature would like those all of those assumptions to be present. Okay, so this is to put things in context. Now, I mentioned dark energy before, and when I give examples of effective field theories, I'm a cosmologist, so I will tend to talk about dark energy or maybe the EFT of inflation, but none of the formalism that I'll be introducing is really associated with dark energy per se. So you may have any low energy effective field theory that may be describing, for instance, the standard model of particle physics as an effective field theory, or you may have other type of effective field theories describing other phenomenon in nature that you may be interested in. Now, if you have a low energy effective field theory, the first thing you can do to probe this low energy effective field theory is simply computing some scattering amplitude. So let me think of computing scattering amplitude as my way of probing my low energy effective field theory. So for instance, if I have quantum electrodynamics coupled to electrons, I can compute some amplitude, for instance, some scattering amplitude of photons. And there's all sorts of messy processes that comes in the game, and I need to introduce the electron loops, for instance, they will come in into computing the scattering amplitude for photon. I'm not gonna compute any real amplitude in here, it's just a formalism. In particular, I can consider an elastic scattering amplitude for two incoming, two outgoing particles. So I have two incoming, two outgoing particles, and I'm considering something which is elastic. So you may think of it as having the outer momenta being related to the incoming momenta. Now, this amplitude, I can compute it in the physical region. I can compute it in the regime of validity of the effective field theory, but I can also consider it in the complex energy square plane. So, and I know that in the complex energy square plane, I will have some poles on the real axis associated with the real physical and massive particles that are present in my low energy effective field theory. And then the loops from the light modes, and then at some point, the loops from the heavy modes are contributing to a branch cut in the amplitude. And that's what gives you an imaginary part for the amplitude on the real axis of this complex energy square plane.
Claudia, sorry, there is a question by Hank.
Yeah.
Yeah, hello. So hi. I have a question regarding the second diagram that you've drawn here.
Oh, no, this is, no. This is symbolic. Don't take that seriously. Just imagine. Okay. No. I just copied up. Just imagine you have a low energy effective field theory, and from there on, whatever are the states present in your low energy effective field theory, you can compute some amplitude. That's all.
Well, yeah, it's because the second diagram relates to the triangle anomaly, right? So it's related to the chiral anomaly. But if you have an anomaly in the, like if you have an anomalous gauge symmetry in the, I think there are, like if you have an anomalous gauge symmetry in the EFT.
So honestly, this is not going to be relevant for what I'll talk about. So don't worry about those diagrams. This is just honestly, if you have that question at the end, just ask me. But for now, it's not going to be relevant. Don't worry about those things.
All right.
This is just my cartoon picture of saying you have a low energy effective field theory, and from there on, you can compute your scattering amplitude at low energy. That's all. Whatever processes comes in the game. So you may have some tree level diagrams, you have some loop level diagrams, that's all. Okay, within the regime of validity of my low energy effective field theory, I can compute and trust the amplitude that I have computed. And there's a region where I believe I will be able to trust the result. If there's no such region, then this low energy effective field theory is not particularly useful. But there's a region where you think you can trust the result from your computation using the low energy effective field theory. And then at some point, your low energy effective field theory will break down because it's not the theory of everything. It's just a low energy effective description. And then you need to introduce new physics that will come in and capture what's happening when you go outside the regime of validity of your low energy effective field theory. And there may be an infinite number of layers of physics that you may need to introduce all the way up to a high energy UV completion of everything. And here I'm not even talking about gravity. And now I certainly don't know how to compute my amplitude at high energy. All I know is the way I computed it at low energy breaks down when I go to sufficiently high energy. However, the amplitude itself does exist independently of my ability to compute it. And so it still seems reasonable for physics to manifest itself in such a way at all energy scale, so as, for instance, to be causal, or so, for instance, so that the amplitude itself satisfies unitarity. Doesn't seem too much to ask those instances. Now, there seems to be a decoupling of scale between what happens at high energy and what will happen at low energy. However, the requirement of causality at this level manifests itself through the requirement of analogicity of the scattering amplitude in a complex energy square plane. And this is in non-gravitational effective field theories, this is relatively well understood, and it can be very much related to, for instance, when you're computing your retarded propagator in Fourier space, you want it to be analytic in half of the complex energy plane, so as to end up with no support outside the light cone, so that you're really dealing with a retarded propagator that only switches on in the future and not in the past. So only after you kick in the system will the system respond to it and not before that. So this is the notion of causality, which at the level of the retarded propagator, for instance, is well understood to manifest itself under a requirement of analogicity. Now this requirement of analogicity can be translated at the level of the amplitude in the fact that the amplitude has to be analytic in the whole of the complex energy square plane, so in the upper half and in the lower half. And ideally, if you have a mass gap as well, you can go from the upper half of the complex plane to the lower half of the complex plane. And it is this analyticity requirement of the amplitude, which really allows you to make contact between the high energy completion. Even though you're not able to compute the amplitude, you can relate some qualities of the amplitude at high energy to some qualities of the amplitude at low energy. So the requirement for analyticity here will be crucial. And I take it almost for granted that the requirement of causality directly demands analyticity. This is a statement you're very welcome to debate, and it is debatable, but I will take it for granted. Otherwise, I can't say very much, unfortunately. Okay, so now that we have...
Sorry, yeah. There is another question by Ding.
Hi, it's a clarification question. When you talk about the effective field theory, are you assuming any particular classical space-time background, like flat space-time?
Okay, excellent. That's a very good question. So far, let me just maybe say here, so far I'm considering a non-gravitational effective field theory, and I'm also assuming Lorentz invariance. So I'm really considering Minkowski flat space-time as my background, as the space-time. And then I'll go into gravitational effective field theories, where this question is very relevant. Yeah. So at the moment, the space-time is just Minkowski. Yeah. And I can't even do that. I can't give you direct answer of how all of this would generalize into, for instance, the sitter background, where I would expect to have the same amount of symmetry. I just can't give you the answer how all of those requirements will be modified. It's actually very complicated. So I can't tell you what happens on the sitter or on EDS, unfortunately.
Thank you, that's clear.
Yeah, so in Minkowski, and I'm dealing with a non-gravitational effective field theory, I'm gonna require physics to be unitary at any scale. And so at the level of this amplitude, it demands me that the imaginary part of the amplitude on the real axis all the way up to infinite energy scale here has to be positive. Really, this is the discontinuity of the amplitude, but for a scalar field theory, that would just be the imaginary part. So that's how the requirement of an unitarity will manifest itself in what I'll be talking about. And I'm also gonna ask for Lorentz invariance and some notion of crossing symmetry. So I'll have that the imaginary part of the amplitude is also positive in the whole of the left-hand branch cut. Okay, now, very crucial to all of that, again, is the requirement of analyticity, which I tried to motivate from the requirement of causality. But if I have analyticity in the whole of the complex plane, aside from poles and branch cuts on the real axis, then really, simply stated, I can perform a Cauchy integration formula, but that's what allows me to determine some values of the amplitude at low energy. This is for small s, for instance, in the regime of validity of the amplitude, and relate this with the integration formula, so the integration of the amplitude along an arc and along the real arc here, that can go all the way up to infinity in principle. So this is where the relation between the requirement that we're imposing on ourselves at high energy and what happens at low energy, this is where this connection is made. So this condition of analyticity, which manifests itself through this integration. Now, what you may or may not like, you're welcome to dislike it, and this is very much something, I'll put it as an assumption, and we'll see what comes out of it. And if you think what comes out of it is too crazy, then you're welcome to say that the reason for that is because this assumption was too strong. I'm very happy for you to take that as a conclusion, if you want to. But I will assume for now a notion of locality which manifests itself under the Poisson bound. So I'm going to ask my amplitude not to go too fast in energy so that this quantity is bounded. Actually, this whole quantity goes to zero as the energy square goes to infinity. And applying this Poisson bounds allows me to send the arcs that I had for the Cauchy integration formula before all the way up to infinity, and the contribution from those arcs then goes to zero. And so I can relate directly the amplitude at low frequencies, or the second derivative respect to the energy of the amplitude at low frequencies, to an integral of the imaginary part of the amplitude all the way up to the on this branch cut. And that, because of unitarity, tells me that this quantity here, has to be positive. Actually, if it is not a free theory, then it has to be positive definite. So this is really it. I'm sorry this was a little bit technical, but that's just the essence of the positivity bounds. In reality, there's an infinite number of information in the positivity bounds, which I'm not going through because they manifest itself through every single partial wave expansion of the amplitude. So you have an infinite number of information, really. But let me just say this is the level of the information that you're capturing at low energy. So the amplitude has to satisfy some positivity bounds of this level so that it will be ultimately embeddable in a standard high energy completion. By standard, I assume it satisfies these conditions. By locality, I really assume this. And if I don't satisfy some of those positivity bounds, then I know that some of those assumptions have to be violated. And actually, you can do a little bit more, which will be maybe useful for what we're going to be doing later on, is to say, if I have a regime of validity for my low energy effective field theory, I can actually compute the loops which are remaining within the regime of validity of my low energy effective field theory and subtract them out. And then the remainder of the amplitude is still, the computation is still coming from the branch cut of physics beyond my low energy effective field theory, which imaginary part should still be positive definite by itself. So you have slightly improved bounds where not only the second derivative of the amplitude has to be positive, for instance, but it has to be even bigger than what you have computed within the regime of validity of your low energy effective field theory. So you can subtract out some contributions, known calculable contributions to your amplitude, and the remainder should still be positive. So just to summarize this part of positivity bounds, at the very least in non-gravitational effective field theory, you try to remain as agnostic as possible within limits of the type of high energy completion that you allowing for yourself. And so I qualify them through these four assumptions. And from those four assumptions, you can derive some conditions that your low energy effective field theory has to satisfy. And so they come under some level of positivity bounds. There's actually an infinite number of positivity bounds because you can apply that with any T derivatives and even higher S derivatives of the amplitude. And then you can do very sophisticated things, which I'm not going to go in details, but you can have actually quite strong constraints on your low energy effective field theory, which you diagnose by computing directly the amplitude in the regime of validity of your low energy effective field theory. And that have to be satisfied if you want your high energy completion to be standard in the sense that they're qualified. And so there's a lot of information carried in there. And tracking them down from the assumptions that I impose on myself at high energy is very straightforward. So there's nothing conjectural about it in this sense. I'm not relying on a specific realizations, for instance. So one of the examples where those type of things are starting to become useful and could be very powerful in the future is just already for the standard model effective field theory. If you don't have a particular model in mind of what comes beyond the standard model, but you're just trying to parameterize any potential operators that may come into the effective field theory for the standard model, you can use those positivity bounds to constrain yourself where in parameter space you expect to be or not. So this is just an example for dimension 8 vector W and Z bosons interactions. They're all written here. Don't worry about those. It's just symbolic at this level. So this is just to say you have some parameters, which are the coupling constant that come into your EFT. And in blue are the regions in parameter space where you expect in the future to being able to rule in or rule out from data, from LHC, for instance. So if those operator were not there, you should be zero within some given certainty confidence level. Now, interestingly, from the point of view of the low energy effective field theory point of view, there's nothing so distinguishable in terms of the validity of the CFD on depending on where you are in this region of parameter space. It doesn't seem to be particular. It's not like one point is stable and another point is unstable. It's just an EFT. But what you can see from applying those positivity bounds is that you need to be in the green region of parameter space so as to satisfy the positive bounds, so as to be able to ultimately enjoy high energy completion, high energy completion, no matter what precisely this standard high energy completion is. And so in principle, if with sufficient accuracy, you convince yourself that you were really in a region of parameter space, which was not in the green region here, for instance, imagine you were really in that point of parameter space with sufficient confidence, then that could rule out string theory, because it would rule out, nature would tell you that the completion of the standard model of particle physics is not something that satisfies, for instance, the level of locality that I'm imposing on myself. And so it can rule some completions out just by observing things at very low energy. You don't need to go to string theory scale to probe it, for instance. So this is something that people can do and apply in those type of bounds for the standard model effective field theory, for instance. But what I'm interested in understanding for the rest of this talk is how we can apply that to gravitational effective field theory, where there's a lot of open questions that emerge. And as soon as you do that, the connection between the assumptions that I'm imposing on myself at high energy and the positivity bounds that are derived becoming much more subtle, and the connection between the positivity bounds and I mentioned a lot of that comes from causality, and usually you think of causality as corresponding to the subliminality of the group velocity at low frequencies. And this seems to be consistent. And you can see that, you can prove that through positivity bounds, for instance. But in gravitational effective field theory, there's a connection to positivity bounds is broken. And this connection to superliminality at low frequency being directly linked to causality violation, this link is also broken in gravitational effective field theories. And you may think, and you'll be absolutely right, that those subtleties should have just gravitational subtleties, and so they should be just M Planck suppressed. So this is not something observable. Why should I care? Why I should maybe just stop talking right now. And maybe that's true. But let me give you a reason of why one should care, why applying those positivity bounds within the gravitational framework is relevant and useful in many situations. So one of the reasons is coming from the weak gravity conjecture, and I think it's a little bit of a mixed audience, so I'm sure some of you are much more familiar than I, even I am, on the weak gravity conjecture, but let me just tell you what I need to know about the weak gravity conjecture to make the point I want to make. So let's imagine you have physics beyond the standard model, which includes some, let's say, some dark photons, a new U1 gauge theory. So you have your new U1. So let's say that's a dark photon on top of gravity. And so if you have that, you can have charge, you'll typically have charged particles with respect to this U1. And in particular, black holes can be charged with respect to this U1. Now, if a black hole is so charged that its charge is equal to its mass, then it's an extremal black hole. Right? And all of this is in units of Planck scale. if a charge was to become larger than its mass, then it would be a super extremal black hole and you'll be led to a naked singularity. So in order to avoid naked singularities, as the black hole evaporates and the mass decreases, the charge of the black hole itself has to decrease more rapidly or at the same rate as the mass itself, so that the black hole remains extremal or sub-extremal, that no naked singularity gets formed. But for that to happen, it means that something must be taken away the charge from the black hole as it evaporates. And so in principle, there should be a massive particle which charge, the on charge of these massive particles has to be at least equal to its mass, if not higher, for this evacuation of the charge of the black hole to be able to occur. So this is a very simplistic way of phrasing it, but it's kind of the essence of the weak gravity conjecture. Now, if you think of it at the level of an effective field theory, then you can take a slightly more agnostic approach as well on what you mean, on whether or not this should be other charged particles. The way you can think about it instead, or in a complementary way, is to think that you have your gauge field coupled to gravity, but everything is just an effective field theory. And so you will have corrections coming in that you can symbolize with operators being written into your low energy U1 effective field theory. And so you have higher order corrections of this form, for instance, and then you have a coupling between your form field, direct coupling between your form field, and W is the Weyl curvature of your spacetime. And so this direct coupling on these corrections will change slightly the solutions of the black hole, and they will redress the black hole mass and the black hole charge. And so in the CFT, accounting for those operators that very naturally come into your low energy effective field theory, that actually should be just implemented in your low energy effective field theory, the new extremality condition is not just one, but it acquires some corrections coming from the corrections of the FT, the operators of the FT. And now if you were able to show from positivity bounds that the coupling constant here are coming in such a way from positivity bounds that the constant here is always positive definite, it would tell you that as the black hole evaporates, the mass becomes smaller, and the sub-extremality condition is more easily satisfied because these contributions become bigger. And so the extremality condition is more easily satisfied as the mass decreases. And so if it was correct that no matter what type of EFT corrections you have, for this EFT to be embeddable in a standard high energy completion, if it was true that they should always come in such a way that this coefficient was positive, then it would allow you to tell you that the weak gravity conjecture is always satisfied. The black holes can always evaporate without leading to naked singularities. And so you don't really need to postulate the existence of other massive charged particles with charges larger than the mass themselves, the mass other than actually the black holes themselves will already satisfy this criteria from decreasing the mass in here. So one of the questions we can ask ourselves is how easy we can just use positivity bounds so as to say that this coefficient should always be positive and actually positive definite. And the answer, the quick answer is it's actually very easy. The same type of bounds that I wrote down before, if you apply it at the level of the amplitude computed in this effective field theory, and forgot for a second that it was a gravitational effective field theory, forgot the word gravity in there and just apply them, you would see something like that entering. And so you would be very inclined to think that you can prove the weak gravity conjecture from those positivity bounds. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, but this is one of the motivations I'm trying to understand how much you can apply those positivity bounds in the gravitational context. The other motivations are a little bit more phenomenological, if it were. For instance, already right now, within the context of the effective field theory of gravity, in this very nice paper, for instance, people are already trying to explore what the effect of operators that come in, irrelevant operators in the effective field theory of gravity would be, for instance, on the waveform of gravitational waves observed from black hole mergers. And so in the future, as lower and lower frequency gravitational wave interferometers are being built, the idea is that one should be able to probe better and better the operators that come into the effective field theory of gravity. And so complementary to that, we'd like to understand in which region of parameter space would this effective field theory of gravity be embeddable in a standard high energy completion. And then you can either take this as prior or you can use it as a posteriori in then really understanding whether the assumptions you impose on yourself at high energy are consistent with what nature gives you or not. And then similarly to this train of thought, you can do the same thing for cosmology, for instance. You can imagine some models of dark energy or modified gravity. So my mouse is not working anymore. Where am I?
Try to click on the presentation.
Yeah, okay, it's back. Thank you. So you can imagine that's just an example of a particular simple model of dark energy or modified gravity. I don't even want to go through the details of it. It's really irrelevant for the point I'm trying to make. All I want to say is that you can parameterize a phenomenon, for instance, dark energy, and then observations will tell you where you expect to be in your parameter space. So in terms of these three parameters, CM, CB, CT, that enters this particular EFT of dark energy, observations, which includes various type of missions, tells you that you're expected to be in this yellow region of parameter space. But now you can complement these observations with those positivity prior. And what you can see, or what you expect to see, is that it will kind of shift where you are in parameter space. So the positivity bounds, you can use them to inform yourself on where observations are really pointed to. So you can use them again as priors, or if you don't want to use them as prior, you can ask yourself how consistent with those positivity bounds observations are. However, all of this, in particular this one, don't take this as literally, because I made a lot of assumptions in being able to apply positivity bounds in the gravitational setup. One of the assumptions I made was the positivity bounds, I derived them on flat space-time. And if I'm talking about cosmology, I'm certainly not on flat space-time. So I really don't have anything to talk about. This is really cartoon-like. I'm kind of putting two disconnected pictures onto one another, but it's hard to see whether that's consistent or not. So really take more as a way to see how bounds on flat space-time would look like if you were to export them on a cosmological background, but it could be that in doing so, you would also distort the bound you have, the positivity bounds that you got. So that's one of the reasons, as was raised earlier, the background itself is relevant when you're trying to apply positivity bounds in the gravitational setup. But even before we go into the background setup, which we may or may not be able to resolve in the future. One of the reasons it's even at zeroth order hard to understand what we mean by positivity bounds in the gravitational setup is because is because of gravity. I guess that's obvious. But what I mean by that is you can't prevent from having a gravitational exchange as soon as you switch gravity on. It's going to start interacting with everybody. And even if you're just interested in computing an amplitude for which you thought gravity was irrelevant, you can't prevent yourself from having the graviton playing a role in this amplitude and leading you a small contribution to the amplitude corresponding to the gravitation, to the graviton exchange. So this is, of course, a Planck scale suppressed. And if you take a limit where the Planck scale goes to infinity, you can switch all of those effects off. So if you switch gravity off, then there's no issue. But as soon as you switch gravity on, you can't help but having a graviton exchange that comes spoiling the applicability of the positivity bounds. And so you may have various type of arguments in saying that, well, maybe this is something I shouldn't really care too much about. It's just a pole, but I can subtract it from the amplitude, and the remainder should by itself satisfy the positivity bounds. And there's been several arguments made of that form and trying to quite convincingly show that this coefficient should still remain positive. But this gravitational exchange, comes in at t zero because it's a massless particle. And you may say, well, the same is true for a photon. So I have a T-channel pole for my photon. Why am I not screaming about the photon coming in and spoiling my positivity? And the reason I don't worry about the photon is because the residue of the pole for the photon, or for any particle, grows like the spin of that particle. And so for the photon, it grows like S, which by itself satisfies the Poisson bound. And so I can subtract it from the amplitude, and the remainder by itself should still satisfy the Poisson bound. And so I can apply positivity bounds to the pole subtracted amplitude if I had, for instance, the pole related to the photon or to another another massless particle or spin less than two. But as soon as you're dealing with the graviton or higher spin than the graviton, the residue grows like a squared or even faster, and so saturates the Poisson bound, which means I can't subtract it from the amplitude without also then running into trouble because the remainder of the amplitude won't satisfy the Poisson bound. It's a whole package that satisfies the Poisson bound. So I can't take something that violates the Poisson bound and then expect the rest to satisfy the Poisson bound. That's certainly not gonna work. And we can see example, for instance, by just considering QED coupled to minimally coupled to gravity, that this coefficient here in the real world, in the sense of real physics that we know very well, and then just couple as naturally as possible to gravity, will lead you to some level of negativity. And you can see this level of negativity at the level of the amplitude itself, or you can see it at the level of causality argument. You can see that if you impose causality directly at the level of those effective field theory, it doesn't demand that the coefficient that would otherwise come here is positive definite. It allows it to be slightly negative. And so this is also related to having a small level of superluminalities in gravitational effective field theories. So as soon as you switch gravity on, a lot of the assumptions that I imposed on myself at high energy are already much more murky. And there's definitely some amount of debate on whether or not we should keep them. And even if I keep them, going from those assumptions to positively like bounds at low energy is much more murky. So I'll go through that quickly because I'll go through my assumptions again one by one. But in the gravitational setup, there's various things that come compromise the applicability of the positivity bounds or even the derivation of the positivity bounds. So the first thing I'm going to do is separate out the various type of contributions from massive and massless particles that come in computing the amplitude, because the massless loops typically break the level of analyticity of the amplitude that I would always need to have for those arguments to work. So if I'm computing a scattering amplitude between a graviton now, I'm interested in scattering a graviton with another low energy effective field guy, whatever it is, I'm computing this scattering amplitude. Now, in this process, there'll be various things that come in the game, but at the moment, I'm mainly interested in the type of loops that come in. So there'll be the loops from the massive fields that are beyond the regime of LTT of my low energy effective field theory. Then there will be the loops from the light fields, which will go all the way up to zero as a branch cut. And there'll be the loops of the gravitons. So let me start with graviton loops and tell you that I'm not going to consider them because I can always take a limit of the amplitude where send the Planck scale to infinity while keeping the Planck scale in front. So I still have something there. Of course, if I didn't have that contribution here and I just send M Planck to infinity, I won't have anything at all. that's not particularly interesting, but I still, by taking this particular scaling limit of the amplitude, I'm allowing myself to see how graviton interact with the rest of the world without needing to worry about graviton loops because they will come in at higher order in the Planck scale. Okay, so that's an easy one to deal with. Then when we're dealing with light loops, in particular, let's say the photon, we have, first of all, the pole associated with these light loops, for instance, the pole of the photon that comes in. And as I mentioned earlier, the pole of the photon itself is harmless because I can just subtract it out of the amplitude. So this is not something I need to worry about. The loops of the other light field are something I should be worrying about. Let me just say, at this level, I'm going to ignore them. The reason I'm going to ignore them is because I don't think they will spoil any of the criteria that I'm imposing on myself on the amplitude. But if you disagree with that, I'm perfectly happy to admit that this is possibly one of the weaknesses of those arguments. And so I'll go through that at the end as well as highlighting as one of the assumptions that I'm making. The reason I'm not too worried about those at the moment is because I know that they will scale like so. And so when I take the second derivative of the amplitude at t is zero, this thing disappears. And so I don't think it's really spoiling much of what I'm going to be talking about, but I'm going to make the assumption that I can ignore light loops. So I'm not going to consider loops of photons, for instance. And so the only thing left I have in the game, aside from all the tree level contribution that I need to compute within a given effective field theory, are the loops from the heavy fields. So that's the first type of assumption that I'm gonna have. Now, the second type of assumption I'm gonna make is the fact that I still want my amplitude to satisfy the Foissart bound. And from this assumption, the requirement of a radio-like behavior will follow. So having a radio-like behavior is not by itself an assumption. It's really a consequence of the fact that I'm asking for the amplitude to satisfy the Foissart bound at large energy square. So what I mean by that is really that I'm asking for the amplitude to satisfy a dispersion relation, which doesn't grow too fast as goes to infinity. And so in five dimensions, for instance, we know that we expect this to be the case. What we know in four dimensions and we know that's the case for t negative and for t positive, is that it definitely satisfies a dispersion relation with three subtractions in the sense that this quantity will go to zero as s goes to infinity. But I like a little bit more than that, and I like this to be the case at t negative for in four dimensions as well. So this is what I take it as an assumption. So now if we have an amplitude of this form, which we assume satisfies a dispersion relation with two subtractions when t is negative, it tells me that I can write it like this as an integral. And because it satisfies this type of relation, the only place where the pole can find itself is actually in this dispersion relation. There's no separate pole in the way I'm writing down the amplitude. So in disguise, the pole, the T-channel pole, is hidden in there. And to see that occurring, we can see what happens when you continue from T smaller, from T negative to T positive. It's slightly easier for me to think of it as a massive particle. So for a second, I'll go through what happens in the case of a massive particle, and then I'll send the mass to zero. That doesn't make much of a difference. But so this is, again, the type of dispersion relation I'm assuming for the amplitude. This is exactly as I wrote it before, where before I had the mass being zero, but otherwise is the same. So those are the contribution, which don't grow too fast. Now, what we want is that the T-channel pole itself, which is hidden in here, be captured inside the dispersion relation. And it has to manifest itself when you switch from T being slightly smaller than M squared to T being slightly larger than M squared, or as we had it zero before. So I'm asking for having dispersion relation with two subtraction T negative, let me just say. And so that tells me that when mu goes to infinity, it's bounded in this form. But I also want at squared, or what was there before, to capture the T channel pole. And therefore, the only way it can be captured at T is M squared is if this dispersion relation diverges. And so we would need to have that this contribution here is saturating the integral. So you need the imaginary part of the amplitude to go like mu squared when T is exactly equal to M squared, what I had been zero before. And then for T greater than M squared, what we all agree on is that the amplitude should by itself satisfy dispersion relation with at least three subtractions. And so at the very least, the amplitude should be bounded of this form. So now for me to be able to transition between a behavior of the amplitude which satisfies this relation when T is smaller than M squared to this relation when T is larger than M squared and being a factor of two exactly when T is equal to M squared, it tells me that the imaginary part of the amplitude for large energy square has to scale as a power of the energy where alpha here is the slope of this power where it's exactly two if T is M squared, and then you have small departure of it such that it's slightly smaller than two when T is smaller than M squared and slightly larger than two when T is larger than M squared. And this is really precisely what the radio-like behavior is. I'm not assuming the radio-like behavior per se, I'm really assuming this condition here. And that tells me that I need to have a radio-like behavior. It's the only way I can manifest that in this way of thinking. So going back to having a massless particle, now with the assumption, the radio assumption for a massless state is that the discontinuity, whatever that's the amplitude, the imaginary part of the amplitude has to scale for small t at the very least, as at large energy, as large mu being the energy here, has to scale as a power low so that this one starts at two and then has a slight slope away from it. And then lambda r here, it corresponds to the scale at which you would expect this radio-like behavior to start kicking in. So typically you would expect this to be a high energy process. So this may start happening at the string scale if you want to commit to being string theory or something which will be related to your high energy physics to be related to more what you're thinking about quantum gravity. This lambda r definitely should be much larger than the other scales present in your low energy effective field theory. Okay, so after this long lecture on why I'm assuming this radio-like behavior or why I'm deriving this radio-like behavior, I'm going to now implement it at the level of the amplitude that I'm deriving so as to get something as closely related to the old positivity bounds that I had before with the knowledge that it'll be slightly different because you need to deal with this T-channel pole and it's this radio-like behavior that allows me to deal with this T-channel pole. So I'm assuming you have these dispersion relations where at some point this radio-like behavior starts kicking in. And it's making these assumptions which allows me to split the amplitude into a part which satisfies three subtractions, which then I know will be finite because the amplitude doesn't grow too fast. So all of this quantity will be finite and I can apply positivity on this. And then some remainder contribution. Now this remainder contribution, I can separate it again into one part which goes all the way up to this lambda r scale, the onset of the radio behavior. This is this contribution. And this again is finite and positive. I don't know what it is, but it's finite and positive. And then the remainder is really captured by the radio-like behavior. So I just put in the radio-like behavior. This is where from where on this behavior has to kick in. And because I kind of have some knowledge on what this behavior has to be like, I can compute this explicitly. And what it tells me is that it's related to the radio slope and the derivatives of the residue, the derivative of the residue of the ray Drupal. And then I can see directly in here, as I perform an expansion of the slope in small powers of t, I can see extracting the t-channel pore that comes in there. So putting all of this together, it tells me that the second derivative of the amplitude has to be larger than all of those contributions positive, and then has to be larger than this one, and then having the t-channel pore. So if I take the pore subtracted amplitude, I remove the pole, the t-channel pole from the amplitude, then a second derivative has to be larger than this contribution. But now the scale captured in the derivative of the residue of the ray J pole and of the derivative of the ray J slope are typically expected, or that's at least what I would have expected naively, to be related to high energy physics, to be related to the onset of quantum gravity, for instance, or the string scale, or whatever you think should be happening. So that would have been my naive my naive estimation, if you had asked me. And not only me, this is, I'm not the only one that thought that. Now, what I'm gonna do in the last 3.5 minutes left that I have, so I'll do that very quickly, is to apply this simply into the simplest example that I can think that exists, which is a scattering amplitude between a graviton and a photon. And I'll call this the HHA, or the haha amplitude, because it's really gravity's way of making fun of me in this case. So I can compute this amplitude, and in looking how graviton interacts with photon, you're going to need to include the effect from all the standard model loops and even possibly beyond. But of course, you have a segregation of scale. And so really, in those processes, the loops of the particles which are the lightest will contribute the most. And so the lightest massive particles beyond the regime of validity of the FT that will contribute. You can do that in the low energy FT, integrating them out, or you can do them by just looking at them directly. In either case, it's really the electron that dominates all of those effects. And you can capture it through a contact term. You don't need to do that, but you can if you want to. Capture it through a contact term of this form, where the coefficient of this contact term, so contact between your photon and the curvature, is captured by the mass of the electron. And so when you send the Planck scale to infinity, in the curvature, you'll have this going to zero, and so you have no effect coming in there. Now, what happens is that if you're considering electromagnetism, and the lightest massive charged particle is the photon, is the electron, is a spin half, is actually contributes to this coefficient with a minus sign. If you were imagining a different scenario where the lightest massive charged particle was a spin zero, it would actually contribute with a plus sign. So in principle, the sign could have come either way, but it doesn't matter, because you can always make a choice of indefinite scattering for your photons. So you prepare your photon state in an indefinite state with the knowledge of what the sign of this coefficient is, in such a way that when you compute the amplitude, you end up with a result which is always negative definite. It's always going to be negative. But this level of negativity has to be bounded by the derivative of the ray J slope and pole, which are typically captured by the scale of high energy physics. But what comes in here is related to the scale of standard model physics, for instance, the electron mass that comes in here. And this is really what is very surprising, is that in the assumptions that we're making, there seems to be a link between the behavior of the ray J slope at high energy, or what you would have thought should be high energy. And really, it is low energy physics. It is related to the electron mass. It is related to the standard model of particle physics, which I consider being low energy physics. So because I'm running out of time, let me just say, I won't go through all of those assumptions, and I'm happy to talk about them. But of course, I made a lot of assumptions in deriving this condition. What you end up with, if you accept the level of locality and causality that we required, if you agree, if you are okay with ignoring the other light loops. And new physics doesn't really come in. I can go through that, but there's nothing really that can help in any way. So if you're okay with those, then what it tells you is that captured in the radio slope, which you thought should be something exhibiting high energy physics, is a scale which should have knowledge of the lightest massive charged particle that exists in nature, in this case, the electron. And so you have a contribution to the radio behavior, to the first derivative of the radio behavior, which is enhanced by close to 40 orders of magnitude as compared to the Planck scale. And so it's not, if you were just thinking that you can do this perturbatively doing a Planck scale expansion or a string scale expansion, because as you go away from T zero, you should have the slope being related to the scale of quantum gravity. That's actually not true. You really have some contribution built in the behavior of the radio pole, the radio behavior that knows about low energy physics. So the scale of low energy physics is captured in this radio behavior when you do an expansion at small t. So I'll just stop here, and I'm happy to go through the various options later, but I think I'm running a bit out of time. So let me just stop here for now. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Claudia, for the great talk. Other questions? Okay, so let me stop. And okay, I see a question by Hank, actually, so Hank, go first.
Yeah, sorry, Alicia. Thank you for the nice talk. I just wanted to go back to the original point I brought up. Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree, but it's because if you have like the chiral anomaly in your EFT, then we know that, well, this is for sure not a standard. There's no standard UV completion in the sense that there's a no-go theorem that says that you cannot, in the deep in the UV, you cannot, the symmetry must be broken in one way or the other, essentially, if you have anomalous symmetry. But there's been work to sort of resolve this anomaly using two groups, like from Clay Cordova's paper, at least in a high energy, like, you know, no gravity considerations. But there's been work to try to use like two groups, essentially like higher groups, to resolve this anomaly. So in a sense, like you would expect that UV theory to at least host like higher symmetries, essentially, right? So symmetries that associated to charges, not only point-like charges, but also string-like charges. So I'm just wondering, like, does it change?
No, that doesn't change at all. I'm making no assumption on what the higher symmetries are. That is not at all part of the considerations. I'm not even considering that you have fields per se at high energy.
Right, you're only looking at the scattering amplitudes.
That's right. So precisely what the all I want is Poincaré invariance to be there at high energy. That's the fundamentally there at high energy. That's the only thing I'm demanding. But the fact that the level of symmetry is not the same, or you have to enhance it, that's not relevant. No. It doesn't manifest itself in any way, because all of that is captured through operators. So it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, the Poincaré symmetry can also, like, space-time symmetry can also be anomalous, but I guess that's like there's less evidence, I would say, for that happening.
I mean, you can maybe have diff if you want, but
yeah.
Poincaré invariance, you typically don't expect that.
I agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, of course, no, they are absolutely high energy completion for which some level of Poincaré invariance may or may not be broken. And then I think the best to make contact with those is to parameterize the violation, and then you can cascade that way down through the positivity bounds to see how much this violation would then manifest itself in a violation of the bounds at low energy.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually like along the lines of what I was thinking about.
Yeah, so you can do that for Poincaré invariants, for instance. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
But see, what I think is interesting though is that it's not a violation of the bounds because the bounds allow them to be negative, but this scale is the electron mass, right? If you want to say this level of negativity is not to do with some funny behavior of the Ragi behavior, but it's really related to some breaking of Lorentz invariants at high energy, then this breaking of Lorentz invariants at high energy has to be captured by the electron mass, which is quite... Yeah, I have no words for that. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a good point, yeah.
Okay, are there other questions? Okay, then, so let me ask my question first. If I understand correctly, your starting point, Lagrangian, is essentially the GR Lagrangian, so the only Einstein-Hilbert term plus U1, also considering higher order
I didn't have the time to go through that. It really doesn't matter. So let me see if I can go. Very good. Okay, very good. So I'm considering GR, and then this is electromagnetism. I'm working in the low energy picture. You don't need to do that. It's just simpler for me to explain here. All the loops from all the standard model particles, all of them for the level at which I'm interested in at the level of the amplitude, they all are captured through this unique operator. So of course, this is not the unique operator in the EFT. There's an infinite number of one, of course, there's an infinite number of them, but what comes in the second derivative of this amplitude at T0 is just that coefficient. You can write down an infinite number of other operators so long as they are covariant operators, and so long as I don't start writing inverse powers of box, for instance, because I don't quite know what I mean by those inverse powers of boxes. So long as I write local operators at the level of the action, there's nothing else that you can write down. This is just a power counting thing. It's just how it comes in at the level of the in energy scale at the level of the amplitude. And this is the only operator. And it's really just one operator. There's nothing else that you can write down that would contribute at that level. You simply cannot add another operator. You can add all the other operators that you want, but nothing else will change this result. So one thing that you can do is think this value of B that I wrote down, being this value here, is what happens if I just include the contributions from what I know exists in the standard model. But it could be that for a reason or another, there's already such an operator being present that has come from having integrated out physics beyond the standard model that I don't know about. And so what can happen is that there's some cancellation from all the fields that come in beyond the standard model that precisely cancel. Bear in mind, those have to couple with a photon. So it's something slightly non-trivial, but they have to come in and precisely cancel what I see is occurring from the standard model. That is definitely a possibility. Then I have this coefficient B being zero, and I have no issue when I compute this amplitude at energy scale below the electron mass, because then it would be exactly zero. But now you can do something slightly different, where you say, I'm not going to compute this amplitude at energy scales below the electron mass. I'm actually going to accept it to be, and I include the loops of what I know exist, for instance, the electron loops and the W loops and everything, because I can impose a slightly better bound when I include them effectively. So I'm computing the amplitude now at slightly higher energy scale, and I know what's going on there. This is the standard model of physics. I'm not inventing any new physics. So then I can subtract out the loops of what I know exist. And if you set things up such that the effective B was zero below the electron mass, then you can't have it zero at the electron mass. And it doesn't matter, the sign of B does not matter, because you can always choose some indefinite indefinite polarization for your photon, such that you will end up with a negative definite value here. So it's not even a matter of me not considering the most general EFT or not allowing for physics beyond the standard model to lead to cancellations. There's simply nothing I can do so that this, I don't have a level of negativity at some point. I will end up with a level of negativity carried by the electron mass at some point.
But can't there be contributions from the gravitational sector in the higher derivatives, even not coming, like classical higher derivatives, not coming from quantum gravity corrections?
Yeah. So, but those would come in with higher powers of S.
Okay.
So this I can, at this level, I don't need to do it, but this has to be valid for S smaller than your cutoff. But I can always take it to be at S is zero if I want to. And all the higher derivatives will cancel out. So the other operators, no matter what I write down here, you can write them down, but I can always take this bound at T and S is zero, and the other operators would be irrelevant.
Okay, I see. Okay, so at the level of this amplitude, yes, you're right, but then I was wondering about the connection between this and the weak gravity conjecture bound, because that would definitely receive a contribution from the higher derivatives in the gravitational sector.
Yes, but it is the way you're trying to prove the weak gravity conjecture through the positivity bounds. So this version of the weak gravity conjecture, you're kind of saying let me ignore the T-channel pole, and then assume that what remains in the amplitude has to be positive definite. Right. This quantity here will be positive definite if I didn't have the T-channel pole. But what you can see is that with the T-channel pole, positivity bounds don't impose this condition to be, this coefficient to be positive. It tells you it has to be not too negative. That's what it tells you. And it has to be not too negative related to, for instance, the cutoff of your EFT, if you want to. But by itself, this is sufficient to spoil this level of proof, because you can't. It doesn't matter too much how negative, how small this quantity is. The fact is, it can be negative.
Okay, I see.
There are examples where it is negative. It's not something I'm just making up because I have a crazy model of massy gravity or something like that. This is what the standard model gives me in the most general way I can couple it to gravity. Any way I want to couple it to gravity, I will have instances where this thing can be negative. And so I have no reason to believe that this necessarily has to be positive.
Then what would be your conclusion, since
my conclusion is I definitely believe the weak gravity conjecture is true, because I think it's quite fundamental in itself. If it wasn't true, then we have much bigger worries. But I think it's not as trivial as saying it's automatically satisfied trivially if you have unitarity and causality at high energy. I think nature needs something slightly different, something slightly more profound has to happen for the weak gravity conjecture to be always true. I don't know what it is, but all I can say is I don't think it is innocent. I don't think the weak gravity conjecture is just an innocent statement. I think there is something quite profound in the fact that it's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Are there further questions or comments? So there is a question by Martin.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you for this really nice talk. I was wondering, is there a positivity bound for any coupling that you could write down? So let's say if you use some arbitrary operator of mass dimension n, could you in principle derive a positivity bound for that?
Okay, very good. That's an excellent question. Almost, but not quite. You need to start with second derivatives in energy. So if you have a potential, if you have something that doesn't vary with energy, with S really, then I can't impose a bound on it. And so this is very different from the Swampland conjecture because they are really able to put constraints on the spread of the potential or slope of the potential. For us, we're completely blind to the potential. But then any operator which has derivative that would come in as at least as S squared in the amplitude or as higher powers of S and T in the amplitude, then you can bound all of those, yeah.
Yes, that's really nice, yeah. And maybe yes, the second small.
Yeah, you have an infinite number of them, but it starts... It starts where I'm having them. So if you're trying to, so at this level, there's not much to talk about. But if I had a scalar field theory and I put a potential for my scalar field, then I wouldn't be able to bound that scalar field.
Yeah, I see that. Maybe a second question also out of curiosity. You, in the beginning, you had an example where you bound provided bounds on. P1 to the fourth power, something like that. And I was wondering, it's a bit curious because there's the Gaussian energy terms of cubic power in the curvature, which didn't appear in that. So
yeah, so I this is not me, this is just motivating other people's work. Motivating you this by saying what other people have been doing. But it's funny you should say that because we did look at the Riemann cube. Precisely the reason you're mentioning. So I think you are you referring to? Sorry, this is slow. Slide just before that. Oops. It's lagging. Sorry. Okay. Are you referring to this?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Very good. And not the Riemann cube. Yeah. So we started doing the same thing for Riemann cube actually, because at least. Naively, from an EFT point of view, you would imagine you could have Riemann cube operators. I'm not entirely sure why in that particular paper that came before what we were doing, they started with Riemann to the four. Maybe one of the motivations is if you're in super symmetric string theory or heterotic string theory, the Riemann cube is zero. So maybe that's one of the motivations. I don't know. There's no reason you shouldn't be able to have a Riemann cube in principle.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So this is one of the we actually started looking at that and then putting some constraints on the coefficient of the Riemann cube from causality arguments as well because they there's various subtleties that occur there. But yeah.
Yeah, that would be really interesting to see something like that.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Are there more questions? Okay, so if not, let's thank again Claudia for the very interesting talk.